Welcome to Circulation on the Run, your weekly podcast summary and backstage pass to the journal and its editors. I'm Dr. Carolyn Lam, associate editor from the National Heart Center and Duke National University of Singapore.
And I'm Greg Hunley, associate editor, director of the Pauley Heart Center at VCU Health in Richmond, Virginia.
Greg, we're going to be talking about ARNIs and renal outcomes in HFpEF. Oh, you got to hold me back. This is going to be such an interesting discussion. But maybe let's grab our coffees. Are you ready to talk about some of the papers in today's issue?
You bet.
Well, the first paper I have really represents a novel gene therapy approach to atrial fibrillation. So, doctors led by Dr. Arora from Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and colleagues used a novel gene therapy approach in a canine rapid atrial pacing model of atrial fibrillation to demonstrate that NADPH oxidase 2 or NOX2 generated oxidative injury by causing upregulation of a constitutively active form of acetylcholine-dependent potassium current, or IKH, is an important mechanism underlying electrical remodeling in the fibrillating atrium.
Wow, Carolyn, very interesting. Tell us a little bit more about this gene therapy approach.
They performed targeted expression of anti-NOX2 short hairpin RNA in the intact atria of the dogs, and then subjected those animals to rapid atrial pacing for a period of several weeks to months. The novel atrial gene therapy approach prevented the development of electrical remodeling and sustained atrial fibrillation, thus demonstrating for the first time a clear causative role for NOX2-generated oxidative injury in the creation as well as the maintenance of electrical remodeling in atrial fibrillation. Furthermore, they demonstrated a likely cellular and molecular mechanism by which oxidative injury created a vulnerable substrate for atrial fibrillation. The results of this study yield, therefore, valuable mechanistic insights into the pathogenesis of atrial fibrillation and have important therapeutic implications for this clinical management.
Very nice, Carolyn. We need more therapies for AFib. Boy, that's so informative. Well, the next paper that I have sort of merges the world of electrophysiology with the world of imaging. And it comes to us from Dr. Michela Casella from Centro Cardiologico Monzino. Among 162 consecutive patients, this study evaluated the combined utility of electroanatomic voltage mapping coupled with cardiovascular magnetic resonance imaging to guide endomyocardial biopsies.
Oh, so interesting. A combined non-invasive and invasive electrical guide to perform cardiac biopsies. Wow. So what did they find, Greg?
So they found that the sensitivity of pooled electroanatomic voltage mapping and cardiovascular magnetic resonance was as high as 95%. EVM and CMR together conferred an endomyocardial biopsy positive predictive value of 89%. Endomyocardial biopsy analysis allowed to reach a new diagnosis different from the suspected diagnosis in 39% of patients. Complication rates were low, mostly vascular access related, with no patients requiring urgent management. Most impressive for this manuscript are the illustrative figures that are provided. It's really a great article for those performing biopsies, doing imaging, or the EP procedures that guide the biopsy process.
Really nice, Greg. Thanks. Now, for the last paper, have you ever thought about atherosclerosis as an autoimmune disease?
Well, I wonder. You know, we're learning so much about our immune systems these days. Perhaps.
Indeed. Throughout the inflammatory response that accompanies atherosclerosis, autoreactive CD4 positive T helper cells do accumulate in the atherosclerotic plaque. Apolipoprotein B100, or ApoB, is the core protein of LDL, really serves as the autoantigen that drives the generation of pathogenic T helper 1 cells with pro-inflammatory cytokine secretion. Yet, there may also exist ApoB-specific CD4 positive T cells with an atheroprotective regulatory T cell phenotype in healthy individuals. And that relationship between the protective ApoB reactive T regulatory cells and the pathogenic T helper 1 cells really has remained unknown until today's paper. And this is from Dr. Lay from La Jolla Institute for Immunology and colleagues. It's really the first report to characterize CD4 positive T cells recognizing ApoB in the mouse with a combination of a novel MHC2 tetramer and single cell transcriptomics, immunoreceptor sequencing, and functional evaluation. And their results demonstrated an unexpected mixed phenotype of ApoB-reactive autoimmune T cells in atherosclerosis and suggest an initially protective autoimmune response against ApoB with a progressive derangement in clinical disease. These findings really identify ApoB autoreactive T regulatory cells as a novel cellular target in atherosclerosis.
Very nice, Carolyn. Boy, that's a beautiful summary. I've got in the mailbag just a couple things to talk about before you get to the discussion of some research letters. There's an ECG challenge from Dr. Gunseline involving a young patient with chest pain. And then Teresa Wang has a very nice case series involving pulmonary hypertension entitled Pressures at an All-Time High.
There's also an On My Mind piece by Dr. Perman on overcoming fears to save lives, so COVID-19 and the threat to bystander CPR in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. There's a research letter by Dr. Meyer on cardiovascular hospitalizations, influenza activity, and COVID-19 measures. Another by Dr. Gerbel on the first in-human experience with inhaled acetylsalicylic acid for immediate platelet inhibition, the comparison with chewed and swallowed acetylsalicylic acid. A final research letter by Dr. Zurich rounds us up regarding neuregulin 1 inducing cardiac hypertrophy and impaired cardiac performance in post-myocardial infarction rats. Very surprising because we thought this was protective. So there you have it for this issue, Greg. Shall we go on to our feature discussion?
Absolutely.
In patients with heart failure, chronic kidney disease is really common and associated with a higher risk of renal events than in patients without chronic kidney disease. In fact, these renal events are really increasing in prominence in the heart failure literature. And so I'm really welcoming the discussion of today's feature paper, which looks at the renal effects of angiotensin neprilysin inhibition in patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction in the Paragon trial. I'm so pleased to have with us the first and corresponding author of this paper, Dr. Finian McCausland from Brigham and Women's Hospital, as well as our associate editor, Dr. Justin Ezekowitz from University of Alberta. Finian, congratulations on this beautiful paper. Could you please tell us a little bit about the overview, what motivated it, what you found?
It's long been, a passion of mine to look at this interaction or intersection between cardiology and renal events. And if the truth be told, I had a moment in my life where I thought about being a cardiologist, but I was swayed in other directions during my training in Ireland. But I've always been very much interested in this intersection, like I said. And so I've had the opportunity to work very closely with Scott Solomon and others at the Brigham who lead many of the heart failure trials that you are all aware of, much more than I have been. And this particular subset of patients with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction is a very unique population that were studied in the Paragon-HF trial. And we thought it was a unique opportunity to look at some of the pre-specified secondary endpoints, which were the renal outcomes, in terms of trying to figure out what the effect of this was compared to valsartan therapy in this patient population. So I think, you know, looking at this intersection between heart failure and preserved ejection fraction and the deterioration of kidney function was the primary driver to look at this in the Paragon heart failure trial and to really look at the comparison between sacubitril valsartan with valsartan in this patient population.
Indeed. Thanks so much, Finian. And here's a confession too. I really liked nephrology during my training. I thought it was really cool and with all the interventions. And so I really admire the many things you think about, especially in these patients who've got multi-system disease. But okay, moving on with Paragon, I know that the secondary outcomes were reported and it was really a striking effect on the renal events. And so glad that you're shedding more light in it. Could you tell us what this paper added?
Yeah, so here we really got into, I suppose, the depth of the renal composite outcome. And just to remind everybody, that was a composite of a 50% or greater decline in eGFR, the development of end-stage renal disease, or death from renal causes. And so this was the composite outcome that was examined. We really evaluated this in a lot more detail, breaking that composite down into its individual components, as well as looking at it in totality. And I think the big takeaway point was that we found there was an almost 50% reduction in this primary renal composite outcome for patients on sacubitril valsartan compared with valsartan.
And what about the components and the sort of further analyses?
Yeah, so getting into the details in a little bit more granularity, the major driver of those events was the 50% or greater decline in eGFR. And that's where the majority of these events really came from over the follow-up of Paragon. And so this was assessed at various study visits throughout the course of the few years that the patients followed up with Paragon. And I think if we look at the slope, and this was clarified in terms of the overall slope analyses of the eGFR, we saw this relatively early separation in favor of sacubitril valsartan, so that there was less decline in eGFR over time compared with valsartan. So I think, this was a supportive finding from the slope analysis that really got to this 50% threshold that many people have examined in greater detail in the cardiovascular literature. So, it takes a fair degree of kidney function decline to really reach that threshold of 50%. And so I think this was a very robust finding supported by the slope analyses.
Yeah, and to the audience that's listening, you have to grab hold of figure 3 of this paper, and that shows the eGFR slopes, which is something that's, I think, really important in current heart failure literature, the concept of the eGFR decline. So really nice work. Congratulations again, Finian. Justin, could you put these findings in context for us?
Finian, once again, congratulations on getting this analysis. Pretty complex area to try to analyze and analyze properly, given that there's an expansive renal literature out there about looking at eGFR and how you look at it. So I think there's a couple of questions that come to mind when we think about the Paragon trial overall. When we think about the protection of the kidneys over 3, 4, or 5 years, my sense was from your analysis, and perhaps you could expand on it, is there seem to be very few events in those people with pre-preserved eGFR, but a greater number of events in those less than 60 mils per minute. And I wonder if you think that there's a more of a unique place for medications such as sacubitril valsartan in that cohort. And if so, is it really that's where all the action is, but there's no real difference? Or do you think there's an interaction there that we should explore?
Thinking back to the entry criteria for Paragon HF, one had to have an eGFR of more than 30 mils per minute at baseline, and you had to go through this kind of complex run-in period where you didn't have elevations of creatinine or potassium that went outside the pre-specified ranges. So after you took that element of, I suppose, what many people would consider hemodynamic changes, acute hemodynamic changes out of it, you were left with participants who entered the double-blind randomized period. And there, I think that's where, again, we started to kind of see most of the endpoints in terms of follow-up, which, again, were mostly the eGFR decline. If you go to Table 2 of the paper, you'll see the composite, the components of the renal composite broken out into those with eGFRs of less than 60 or 60 or greater at baseline. And even in both groups, I think you'll find that, again, they were both driven by the 50% decline, but you only really saw the end-stage renal disease events or very few deaths from renal causes in those with eGFR of less than 60 mils per minute at baseline. And I think really what that speaks to is that, these are the patients with quote-unquote chronic kidney disease at baseline are the ones who have that decrement in kidney function to begin with and so are more likely to progress, as we know, than those with more preserved kidney function. And so if you follow patients with fairly good kidney function over time, it's going to take a long time before they get that really severe decline due to the compensatory mechanisms that the kidney has to preserve eGFR in the face of decline. So I think once you get into the more advanced disease, you really start to see the deterioration where there's very little renal functional reserve to cope with any additional damage or hemodynamic changes. So to me, it wasn't particularly surprising that that's where the action was. To answer your second point of, you know, should we be focusing therapy here? If you look at the median GFR in the Paragon Heart Failure study, it was around 63 mils per minute. So about half of these patients, I suppose, could be classified as having impaired kidney function if you look at it by CKD criteria of eGFR of less than 60. And so I think there's a huge opportunity there to really think about this population in terms of trying to look for interventional studies and potentially protective agents, as we've seen with this molecule and also with others such as SGLT2 inhibitors. What I would be really intrigued about is if this was persistent at eGFRs below 30, because of course, one of the most devastating outcomes for patients with kidney disease that we deal with is the development of end-stage renal disease and those who go on to hemodialysis. So if there was some mechanism to prevent those even higher risk patients from progressing, I think that would be a huge opportunity for further research in this area.
Thanks for that very complete and thorough answer, Finian. And that actually maybe leads to putting this in context for the majority of people who will read Circulation, and the audience will most likely be cardiovascular specialists and understand a lot of what you've said. But could you put this in context with other studies that really are nearby to this trial, such as Credence, where the eGFR slope might be slightly different, or even the UK HARP3 trial where the same molecule was used but in a different population? I wonder if you could give us some context for these findings.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think the UK HARP3 trial maybe is the first one to discuss. And so this was a comparison of sacubitril valsartan versus irbesartan. This was a study performed in the United Kingdom. And they recruited patients with chronic kidney disease. A small proportion of those patients had heart failure, but this was not any of the pre-specified entry criteria for this study. And their primary outcome was a change in measured glomerular filtration rate after 12 months. And really, they found that there was no significant difference at the 12-month mark between sacubitril valsartan versus irbesartan. And so we were asked a similar question when we presented this study in abstract form at the American Society of Nephrology meeting in Washington last year. And I think a lot of the differences potentially related to the difference in entry criteria for the patients. But also, one might argue that, you know, 12 months of follow-up may not have been enough to see these differences in eGFR slope, which tend to occur, I suppose, rather later in the course of progressive kidney disease and heart failure. And so that may be part of the reason that we didn't see the differences with UK HARP3. In terms of Credence, obviously a different molecule. You know, if you look at our mean eGFR decline over time in Paragon HF, it was around 0.7 mils per minute per 1.73 meters squared per year. And so this compares with about 1.5 mils per minute in Credence. Remember, Credence recruited patients with chronic kidney disease. Paragon HF recruited patients with heart failure and preserved ejection fraction. So differences in terms of the inclusion criteria right off the bat. I think other big differences were that Credence compared canagliflozin versus placebo. There was an active comparator in Paragon HF in terms of it was sacubitril valsartan versus valsartan. So that we saw differences in eGFR slope despite an active comparator, I think was also quite telling, and that there appears to be some additional renal benefit in the addition of sacubitril versus RAS inhibition alone. So I think, you know, the mechanisms is a whole other area ripe for research. I don't think we're entirely clear of the underlying mechanisms of this potential renal benefit. But I think, you know, we're pretty excited in the kidney community now, where now we have several molecules that may have potential to slow kidney function decline, SGLT2 inhibitors being one class, potentially sacubitril valsartan in another, and the top line results from finerenone are just out as well. And so there's all ongoing trials that are looking at kidney function outcomes there. So we're getting pretty excited, and we're not quite as jealous of the cardiology community as we used to be.
I couldn't think of a better way to summarize those findings and to put it into the context of other very hopeful medications for the cardiorenal outcomes. Thank you so much, Finian, for joining us today and for publishing such a great paper with us at Circulation. And thank you, Justin, for your perspectives.
Thanks, Carol. And Finian, congrats to your team as well. This has been a terrific paper to be able to handle and read and look at figure three, and it tells a lot of the story of what you saw.
Thank you very much again for the opportunity, and a big shout out to everybody that worked on Paragon HF, and especially to the support from Scott Solomon and John McMurray for getting me involved. It's a pleasure to be part of this.
Thank you so much from Greg and I for joining us today. Tune in again next week.
This program is copyright the American Heart Association 2020.